Okay. Oh, I should have my page there earlier, sorry. Hi. I'm going to read you a few snippets now from a novel that I finished a little while back. And a part of it is coming out in the Paris Anthology, which is Tightrope Books. And that's been published, I think, next month. And the novel is called Bidden's Last Folly. And I'm going to read you a couple of snippets from the middle of this story. I'll just tell you a little bit about... I won't tell you the whole story, I'll just tell you a little bit about the sort of character that's leading us in. Okay, it's 1885, and Albertine de Villa is an impoverished lady's companion, and she's taking time off to visit her uncle Oswald Catterick and his family. Albertine appeared at the Chelsea front door just after 6 o'clock. The maid told her that one of Mr. Catterick's artistic salons was in session. Albertine had always evaded these forums of idle expostulation, so she hurried straight upstairs. Her uncle Oswald Catterick had long laboured to assume a languid effect, but there were chinks in it, and through these, his inherently strident character burst out. Uncle Oswald painted female nudes, frowning, in unkempt oriental palaces, fragmented vases at their feet. His latest oeuvre was entitled Salome, surveyed by her attendants, dons her seven veils in preparation for her unholy dance. Uncle Oswald courted the company of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood in their heyday. Rossetti's commitment to the depiction of sincere emotion is so profound, he would declare. He always made a habit of attaching himself to any association that he perceived to have bohemian leanings, such as the Most Ancient Order of Druids and the Dialectical Society. Aunt Elizabeth, on the other hand, was a hopelessly respectable person, bemused by her husband's conversations with the aesthetes, mystics and liberals invited into their drawing room. Their daughter Amelia revelled in these gatherings, particularly in the compliments that the old roués paid her when her parents were out of earshot. She was a pretty girl of 18, indulged by both parents, inclined to despise anyone whom she judged as inartistic, poor or dull. She'd already been painted by several of her father's acquaintances, and she liked nothing more than to unpin her lustrous shawl of strawberry fair hair and pose, poetically enrobed in green medieval gowns. She viewed Albertine as an unfortunate dependent on her charity. Aunt Elizabeth happened to be on the second floor landing as Albertine appeared there. The hopelessly respectable aunt insisted on helping her off with her travelling cape so that she might be brought down to the drawing room. You know, you've always been far better at that sort of thing than I. Albertine raised her eyebrows and allowed her aunt to propel her downstairs. In Albertine's opinion, the Catterick drawing room resembled the dark red interiors of the uncle's paintings, minus only the broken crockery strewn on the floors. That evening it contained Uncle Oswald, Aunt Cousin Amelia, and five unknown persons. The conversation revolved around the artistic merits, or otherwise, of being cremated at the appropriate point in one's life. A few months earlier, a certain Mrs. Pickersgill had become the first person to have been legally cremated in England. One of the gentlemen in the Catterick drawing room claimed a distant connection with Mrs. Pickersgill, but the others held her to be a reprehensible sort of woman. I agree with the Catholics, drawled a thin young man with a wispy beard and a habit of leaning very far to his right. How on earth is the Almighty to resurrect a charred corpse? It all sounds so terribly scientific and violent, breathed an ample woman in a ruddy purple gown. Of course it's a dreadful notion. Oswald Catterick eyed the room to assure himself of general approval before continuing. Only brutes like Dr. Price would dream of such an unpicturesque farewell to their relatives. Roasted his infant son's body on a pyre, positively Neanderthal, was it not? Catterick did not mention that 2 years earlier he'd sympathised with the unconventional Price as a fellow juridical enthusiast. The 83-year-old Price had attempted to cremate the body of his 5-month-old son, eccentrically christened Jesus Christ, but had been stopped by the police halfway through. The case went to trial, and the judge ruled that future cremations in England should be legal, provided they did not disturb the peace. Back then, Catterick had expressed outraged sympathy when Price was awarded a mere farthing in damages. "Yes, Catterick, a lamentably brutish to-do," said a grey-bearded man near the door. "I find it quite impossible to imagine a scene more dignified, more charmingly tragic than a well-orchestrated burial on a rain-sodden Flemish mountainside with 12 Orthodox priests in their shining white habits, the sky a most miserable slate grey," he began. "Better still, a snow-laden Grecian mausoleum in the most rugged highlands of Scotland, Carmelite nuns bowing in a row, and a majestic stag erect in the foreground," interrupted his neighbour, whose grey beard was slightly bushier. Amelia Catterick, seated between the beards, sighed, "I would so adore to be painted with a stag." A man with neatly combed iron grey hair remarked, "At the rate our population is expanding, interment will soon become a privilege reserved only for the rich. Cremation is a far more hygienic disposal. Typhoid epidemics are certainly unpicturesque." This was the individual who had been acquainted with the late Mrs. Pickersgill. Acute distaste gripped the faces of most of the company. The purple-clad woman seized the sides of her chair and jerked it back a few inches. The Flemish mountainside enthusiast turned to Amelia, pressing his bulky palms together. "A stag? Far too prosaic for you, my dear Amelia. Your ethereal presence would be far better suited to the company of mythical beasts. Yes, I see you cloaked in brilliant cerulean at the soaring portal of a crumbling Mesopotamian desert city. Your tiny hand resting on the back of a griffin's wing." "Just so." He took her hand and placed it on the arm of his chair, very close to his broad knee, where he set about arranging her fingers in the appropriate manner for resting on griffin's wings. "Griffins? No, Amelia should be painted with a great wild cat," insisted the bushier greybeard. "I see her with a raging lion charging across the wheaten plains of Mongolia towards a Hunnish citadel." "The lion would have its mane flying, intertwined with her golden hair. You should not see where the lion stops and where Amelia begins." He raised a hand towards her hair and touched it with a light sweeping motion, as though he wished to see it tumble down right there in the drawing room, whilst his neighbour went on to question the propriety of wild cats sharing canvases with young women at all. Cats being quite different to griffins. Have I got time for another little snippet? Yeah? Okay. Move on a little bit. Albertine, the lady's companion, who sort of disappeared a bit towards the end there, put in the shade. She's now back at work, and as I said, she's a lady's companion. She and a maid, who's called Rachel, are accompanying Miranda Bitton, who's one of the central characters, to the continent, because Miranda is bereaved, and she needs to recover from the shock of her fiancé's death in the Nile expedition. He had a horrible death of dysentery, and then his body got lost in the Nile. Okay. Clad in crow black, three English women in the Hôtel de Cresson sat ranged at their salon window, overlooking the sweep of Place de la Concorde. Below them, a human clamour rose and fell, its hundreds of thousands of feet shuffling on the cobbles. Threading sedately through this murmuring swarm of flesh was a procession, and though the air above was awash with black-edged flags, the sky looked lonely beside the masses on the earth. "Such aplomb and such dignity, all for a poet!" exclaimed Albertine de Beer. "I could never imagine such a crowd," said Miranda Bitton. "Who would have thought foreigners could behave so nicely?" said Rachel, their maid. "Yes, I don't mind the shops all being shut, not at all," said Miranda. "It would have been acutely taxing to have carved a path through those crowds in any case. said Albertine. None of them mentioned that far quieter memorial service they'd recently attended in Richmond, though it was fresh in all their minds. It was a gratifying spectacle. Rows of braided Republican guards, the brassily sighing military bands, a vast drum corps who tolled dull beats on the stretched dead skins of their instruments, exactly like the rhythm of English church bell tones. Then the immense sarcophagus, trimmed with black and white rosettes, high on its hearse, pulled by blue-black horses. The hearse was followed by a huddle of slightly bewildered people, whom Albertine deduced to be the family. Then there was a battalion of men with plumply puffed out black waistcoats. Ministers of the Third Republic government, according to Albertine. Three governments? How strange, said Miranda. Why do they have three of them? She insisted. But Albertine was staring at the spectacle and didn't seem to hear. Phalanxes of schoolboys, each solemnly gripping a portrait, paced importantly behind several dozen carts, piled high with wreaths, as though on their way to some morose marketplace. The head of Victor Hugo's burial procession would reach the Panthéon, four whole arrondissements away, whilst its end still straggled under the Arc de Triomphe, Albertine explained, as much to herself as to anyone else. It was the first day of June, 1885. By the time they thought of leaving Paris, the city had simmered down through its sleepy summer haze, as though it's lost all recollection of the great swarms of people clogging its streets. In front of the Croissant one morning, Miranda's borzoi hound trotted over to sniff at a clutch of tattered infants who stood gaping at the succession of black boxes, valises and trunks being loaded onto the two carriages. The bitten luggage had swollen to accommodate all Miranda's purchases and now included a further three trunks, black gowns, black cloaks, skirts, black hats, black blouses, maid's uniforms fashioned in black poplin. In her travel reticule, Miranda now carried a copy of Les Misérables, and assisted by her dictionary, she had read the whole of the first page. The flat somberness of their clothes was not kind to the three women in the stifling July heat, but they endured it all without complaint and climbed into the carriage that was to take them to the Gare Saint-Lazare. From there, they would depart from the pure Swiss air of Lake Davos. Outside the carriage, an urchin with mud on one cheek tugged at the borzoi's ear. The other children remained transfixed by the black-clad foreign women and their innumerable belongings until the liveried doorman of the Croissant hastened across to grab the dog's collar, shooing the small Parisians away. Did you know that in French, misérable means poor as well as terribly sad? Miranda told Albertine brightly. Rachel fixed her eyes on Miranda and resolved to tell her the truth about Tristan as soon as they reached the new place. Miranda still looked peaky. There's a deep, dark, filthy secret. Miranda still looked peaky, the maid thought, and journeys were never comfortable. She tucked her mistress into the corner and measured out a small beaker of her medicine, J. Collis Brown's chlorodyne. It was a tincture of morphine, cannabis and alcohol, and Miranda found it most soothing. Chlorodyne can alleviate every physical complaint known to the civilised world, its makers claimed. Miranda was sure it could. Her pale brown lashes closed, and she wafted away, imagining herself enveloped in a bridal gown fashioned from darkest Egyptian water.